Chapter 36. The New Democratic Republics of America and France. First, inconveniences of the great power system. Second, the 13 colonies before their revolt. Third, civil war is forced upon the colonies. Fourth, the War of Independence. Fifth, the Constitution of the United States. Sixth, primitive features of the United States Constitution. Seventh, revolutionary ideas in France. Eighth, the revolution of the year 1789. Ninth, the French crowned republic of 89-91. Tenth, the revolution of the Jacobins. 11th, the Jacobin Republic, 1792-94. 12th, the Directory. 13th, the pause in Reconstruction and the dawn of modern socialism. First, when Gibbon, nearly a century and a half ago, was congratulating the world of refined and educated people that the age of great political and social catastrophes was past, he was neglecting many signs which we, in the wisdom of accomplished facts, could have told him portended far heavier jolts and dislocations than any he foresaw. We've told how the struggle of the 16th and 17th century princes for ascendancies and advantages developed into a more cunning and complicated struggle of foreign offices, masquerading as idealized great powers, as the 18th century wore on. The intricate and pretentious art of diplomacy developed. The prince ceased to be a single and secretive Machiavellian schemer and became merely the crowned symbol of a Machiavellian scheme. Prussia, Russia, and Austria fell upon and divided Poland. France was baffled in profound schemes against Spain. Britain circumvented the designs of France in America and acquired Canada, and got the better of France in India. And then a remarkable thing occurred, a thing very shocking to European diplomacy. The British colonies in America flatly refused to have further part or lot in this game of great powers. They objected that they had no voice and no great interest in these European schemes and conflicts, and they refused to bear any portion of the burden of taxation these foreign policies entailed. Taxation without representation is tyranny. This was their dominant idea. Of course, this decision to separate didn't flash out complete and finished from the American mind at the beginning of these troubles. In America in the 18th century, just as in England in the 17th, there was an entire willingness, indeed a desire on the part of ordinary men, to leave foreign affairs in the hands of the king and his ministers. But there was an equally strong desire on the part of ordinary men to be neither taxed nor interfered with in their ordinary pursuits. These are incompatible wishes. Common men can't shirk world politics and at the same time enjoy private freedom. But it's taken them countless generations to learn this. The first impulse in the American revolt against the government in Great Britain was therefore simply a resentment against the taxation and interference that followed necessarily from foreign policy, without any clear recognition of what was involved in that objection. It was only when the revolt was consummated that the people of the American colonies recognized at all clearly that they had repudiated the great power view of life. The sentence in which that repudiation was expressed was Washington's injunction to avoid entangling alliances. For a full century, the United Colonies of Great Britain in North America, liberated and independent as the United States of America, stood apart altogether from the blood-stained intrigues and conflicts of the European foreign offices. Soon after, from 1810 to 1823, they were able to extend their principle of detachment to the rest of the continent and to make all the New World out of bounds for the scheming expansionists of the old. When, at length, in 1917, they were obliged to re-enter the arena of world politics, it was to bring the new spirit and new aims their aloofness had enabled them to develop into the tangle of international relationships. They weren't, however, the first to stand aloof. Since the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, the Confederated States of Switzerland, in their mountain fastnesses, had sustained their right to exclusion from the schemes of kings and empires. But since the North American peoples are now to play an increasingly important part in our history, it'll be well to devote a little more attention than we have hitherto given to their development. We've already glanced at this story in Section 8 of the preceding chapter. We'll now tell a little more fully, though still in the barest outline, what these colonies were, whose recalcitrance was so disconcerting to the king and ministers of Great Britain in their diplomatic game against the rest of mankind. Second, the extent of the British colonies in America in the early half of the 18th century is shown in the accompanying map. The darker shading represents the districts settled in 1700, the lighter the growth of the settlements up to 1760. It'll be seen that the colonies were a mere fringe of population along the coast, spreading gradually inland and finding in the Allegheny and Blue Mountains a very serious barrier. Among the oldest of these settlements was the colony of Virginia, the name of which commemorates Queen Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen of England. The first expedition to found a colony in Virginia was made by Sir Walter Raleigh in 1584, but there was no permanent settlement at that time, and the real beginnings of Virginia date from the foundation of the Virginia Company in 1606 in the reign of James I, 1603 to 1625. The story of John Smith and the early founders of Virginia, and of how the Indian princess Pocahontas married one of his gentlemen, is an English classic. In growing tobacco, the Virginians found the beginning of prosperity. At the same time that the Virginian Company was founded, the Plymouth Company obtained a charter for the settlement of the country to the north of Long Island Sound, to which the English laid claim. But it was only in 1620 that the northern region began to be settled, and that under fresh charters. The settlers of the northern region, New England, which became Connecticut, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts, were men of a different stamp to the Virginia people. They were Protestants, discontented with the Anglican Church compromise, and Republican-spirited men, hopeless of resistance to the grand monarchy of James I and Charles I. Their pioneership was the Mayflower, which founded New Plymouth in 1620. The dominant northern colony was Massachusetts. Differences in religious method and in ideas of toleration led to the separation of the three other Puritan colonies from Massachusetts. It illustrates the scale upon which things were done in those days, that the whole state of New Hampshire was claimed as belonging to a certain Captain John Mason, and that he offered to sell it to the king, King Charles II, in 1671, in exchange for the right to import 300 tons of French wine free of duty, an offer which was refused. The present state of Maine was bought by Massachusetts from its alleged owner for £1,250. In the civil war that ended with the decapitation of Charles I, the sympathies of New England were for the Parliament, and Virginia was cavalier. But 250 miles separated these settlements, and there were no serious hostilities. With the return of the monarchy in 1660, there was a vigorous development of British colonization in America. Charles II and his associates were greedy for gain, and the British Crown had no wish to make any further experiments in illegal taxation at home. But the undefined relations of the colonies to the Crown and the British government seemed to afford promise of financial adventure across the Atlantic.